Back in 96, Atlanta was booming with excitement around hosting the Centennial Olympic Games. And then, a deranged zealot, willing to kill for a cause, lit a fuse that would change my life and so many others forever, rippling out for generations. Listen to Flashpoint on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Katie Lowes.
And I'm Guillermo Diaz.
And we're the hosts of Unpacking the Toolbox, the Scandal Rewatch podcast where we're talking about all the best moments of the show.
Mesmerizing.
But also, we get to hang out with all of our old Scandal friends like Bellamy Young, Scott Foley, Tony Goldwyn, Debbie Allen, Kerry Washington.
Well, suit up, gladiators. Grab your big old glass of wine and prepare yourselves for an even more behind-the-scenes stories with Unpacking the Toolbox.
Listen to Unpacking the Toolbox on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts,
or wherever you get your podcasts.
Meet the real woman behind the tabloid headlines in a personal podcast that delves into the life of the notorious Tori Spelling as she takes us through the ups and downs of her sometimes glamorous, sometimes chaotic life and marriage.
I just filed for divorce. Whoa. I said the words that I've said like in my head for like 16 years. Wild.
Listen to Miss Spelling on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It was the summer of 1996 in Upper Manhattan, while the violence of the crack epidemic continued to rage. On July 15th, a man survived a gunshot on 159th Street. On August 30th, another man wasn't as lucky at a bus stop on 145th. On September 20th, gunshots erupted on 158th Street and police chased down a white sedan that had sped away from the scene with two young men inside, Pedro Guzman and Jerome Curry. Detectives told them that they'd found a gun in their wake, and eventually Guzman named Jerome and their friend Miguel Enriquez, saying that the gun was used in the August 30th murder as well. Over a day later, Jerome said the same thing, additionally admitting to the July 15th shooting. Either those detectives hit the jackpot, or this is wrongful conviction. Wrongful conviction has always given voice to innocent people in prison, and now we're expanding that voice to you. Call us at 833-207-4666 and tell us how these stories make you feel and what you've done to help the cause, even if it's something as simple as telling a friend or sharing on social media. We've really appreciated hearing from our audience, so much so that we've included one of the messages at the end of this episode, so stick around for that. And if you have something to say, we definitely want to hear it. And you might just hear yourself in a future episode. Call us, 833-207-4666. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction. Today's episode is a case that you're not going to want to hear, but you need to hear the story of Mr. Jerome Curry. And Jerome is on the phone with us now. First of all, I'm sorry for everything you've been going through for, Jesus, almost three decades.
Yes.
But I'm very honored to have you here on the show.
Well, I'm honored also to be on the show, man.
Yeah, and joining us once again to help tell this story, my friend, attorney Justin Bonas. Justin, welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be back on.
So, Jerome, take us back to before all of this horrible stuff happened.
I was born in the Dominican Republic. I spent some years out there. I grew up in between two different family structures, social structures. Like on my father's side, all of his children and everybody else in the family, they were all graduates from college and university. They were professionals, so like a middle class sort of family. And on my mother's side, basically, no one had graduated from college, or some people couldn't even read and write. So it was a very poor family in a very rough neighborhood. I kind of grew up there more than with my father. I used to like it there more because I had cousins. And in the late 70s, my mother met an American doctor. They married, and he brought her over to the United States. And about a year later, I came over to Trenton, New Jersey. It was rough. I didn't know English, and I'm dark-skinned, so I experienced bullying abused by other kids, but I ended up getting a good education, graduating, and I moved over to New York.
Jerome first moved to 159th Street in Washington Heights, an area that was deep in the throes of the crack epidemic. But then soon, Jerome found a safer place in the Bronx, where he met his co-defendants, Miguel Enriquez, and unfortunately, the guy who sold him down the river, Pedro Guzman.
I had just really met the guy around the time that we both got arrested. Enriquez introduced me to him. You know, he worked for the super of the same building where I lived, and he kind of gravitated towards me, so we started hanging out together. You know, I used to like smoking weed. He smoked weed, but I never really knew much about the guy. So, you know, we all had moved to the Bronx around that time because Washington Heights, or the upper west side of Manhattan, was very, very different, man. They was moving at a different speed. It was a huge drug enterprise. So everybody in there, the businesses, everybody was involved in something. Even the people that were not committing crimes were right there in the middle of everything.
Crack epidemic era Upper Manhattan was rife with violence, but that doesn't excuse how our civil rights were regularly trampled to clear sometimes multiple open cases. If you recall what happened to Rafi Martinez, which we're going to link that incredible story in the episode description, he became the scapegoat for drug trafficking on West 157th Street and three violent crimes. And this case bears some resemblance, as the police were willing to, once again, use false statements to clear a July 15th assault with a deadly weapon, an August 30th murder, and an attempted murder on September 20th. And in this story, we have a known repeat offender with whom Justin has had some contact, Detective B.A. DeLeon.
Elpidio B.A. DeLeon. They cleared the books. That's what they did back then. I mean, B.A. told me that. About Rafi. That's what they did back then. I mean, even now in modern times is when they think they can throw everything on a guy, that's what they're going to do. The funny thing is B.A., he's in the Jabbar Walker case. Jabbar Walker was exonerated November 27th, 2023. The Innocence Project, from everyone that I've spoken with, have stated that in that case, there was fabricating and manufacturing evidence from B.A. DeLeon. And we also know about DeLeon that he was found in 1990 to have used force against a witness in another case in order to get a statement. I could tell you that it almost never happens 30 years ago that the Civilian Complaint Review Board and the NYPD internally substantiate a use of force allegation. And that's before we get to Jabbar Walker's case, which took place around the same time as Curry's. So it's kind of like a clear the books type of situation with the drone. The July attempted murder and then the September 20th attempted murder were both in the 33rd precinct. And then the murder of Reginald Myers is in the 30th precinct. So this is what brings DeLeon in. So you get these statements that are obviously fabricated and manufactured, not only because they're identical, but also because they are demonstrably false. Okay. But the other detectives, he was the more senior detective, it appears, and he was the one that took the lead, driving the investigation with regard to the other cases.
So let's start with the assault of Reginald Frazier on July 15th of 1996.
According to him, it was late at night, around 10 o'clock. He says that it was a male black, 18 to 20 years of age. They had an argument walking down the street from the middle of the block to the corner of 159th Street in Broadway. And that the argument got a little heated, and the male black pulled out a gun on him and shot him on the buttocks when he tried to flee away from them. Reginald Frazier, he's African-American, so he will know for a fact whether he's talking to an African-American or Latino that was of dark skin. He definitely would have been able to distinguish that.
Now, Jerome was 5'7", with dark skin and a thick Dominican accent.
In fact, my English back then, my accent was a little stronger. Now it has gotten better through education and studying and reading and, you know, improving my pronunciation, but it was definitely a lot stronger back then. So he would have known the distinction immediately.
Nevertheless, Reginald Frazier initially reported a young black male as his assailant, not an Hispanic male. But eventually, Frazier identified Jerome and changed his story to say that an Hispanic male was his assailant. And we'll get into the suggestive nature of his ID, as well as Frazier's predicament later on. But first, back to July 15, 1996. Detectives from the 33rd Precinct had no leads. And then, in the 30th Precinct, on August 30th, 1996, there was the murder of Reginald Myers.
You got two Reggies in this case, a Reggie Frazier and a Reggie Myers. Myers is the deceased. Frazier is alive. My focus has been on the Myers case because you got to take one case at a time. If you don't, you're going to confuse a judge. I think you got to focus on Myers first because there is a landslide worth of evidence. Forensic, medical, one of the people that was in the car has come forward with an affidavit detailing who the killer was and that it wasn't Jerome and he wasn't there.
During this time, I was visiting Trenton, New Jersey with my girlfriend, visiting my mother's house. I was out there with friends and spending some time out there.
Many years later, Jerome's co-defendant, Miguel Enriquez, made it clear that he committed this crime with Pedro Guzman and another man.
Yes, he mentioned Marcos, and then he nicknamed him Boas. This was the guy that was supposed to have fired the shot on the night of the murder.
From my investigation, Enriquez, Guzman, and a man named Marker Laboa are looking for someone to rob. This is the west side of Harlem. And there was a lot of people running around with, I guess, a lot of weight and drugs. So, you know, guys would drive around, you had stick up kids. And on 145th Street, Enriquez, Guzman, and Laboa, they see this man who happens to be Reginald Myers with a bag in his hand. They think that he has drugs in the bag. Turns out that he just got some like Gatorade and like a Snapple or something like that. And Enriquez gets out of the car, grabs the bag. Myers chases Enriquez back to the car and a gunshot goes off.
EMS arrived around 9 p.m. and Myers was pronounced dead at the hospital. Detective De Leon arrived around 9:15 p.m. and according to police reports that were not presented at trial. Eyewitnesses said that a man around 6 feet tall grabbed the bag and returned to a dark gray sedan. As Myers reached for the guy who robbed him, the car pulled off toward Amsterdam Avenue and shots were fired. The following day, the autopsy revealed stippling, suggesting a close-range shot with no impediments. It was determined that a 9mm bullet passed through the back of his upper right arm into the armpit, striking his lungs and heart. The witnesses and trajectory suggest that the victim reached for the sedan's passenger side and was shot as the sedan pulled away. Yet, the state's narrative had Myers slapping the windshield of a stationary vehicle and was shot with a .38 caliber bullet through the windshield, which is simply not supported by the facts. But that narrative didn't emerge until September 20th. Now, Jerome was back from New Jersey and was driving around Washington Heights near his old apartment with Pedro Guzman.
No, this is what we did. We party, smoke marijuana, hang out, look for girls. So we ended up driving down the streets, and we ended up coming into 158th Street. While in the middle of the block, a shootout happens. For what I was told, it was over a drug spot that they had, a crack spot that they were fighting over. It was individuals from that block, Reginald Frazier and his friends.
Yep, the same Reginald Frazier from the July 15th assault was involved in a shootout over a crack spot in which his friend, Thomas Joe Long, ran toward Amsterdam Avenue with the one-way flow of traffic on his right and the buildings on his left.
He shot on the left shoulder, and the shot supposedly came from his right side of a car that was riding along the streets. But his left shoulder is facing the buildings as he's running towards Amsterdam.
Even though the bullet entering and exiting through his upper left shoulder supported that the shooter was on the sidewalk, the police radio reported that the shots came from a white sedan. The make and model varied, but this placed suspicion on Jerome Curry and Pedro Guzman, who were in a white Nissan Maxima.
In the middle of this, we did what we thought was logical at that moment, and we also sped out of the block. The police start chasing us, you know, even though the victims had identified multiple different cars. It just happened that our car was also white. Now, on that night, we had a substantial amount of marijuana in there. We ain't had no identification, no license. We ain't even have paperwork for the car, even though the car was legit. Guzman was driving. He panicked. He said, I'm not stopping. I'm not stopping. I'm going. You know, I didn't try to stop him. What I did was I tried to get rid of the marijuana we had in there, and we just ran as much as we could.
They sped toward the Macombs Dam Bridge on their way back to the Bronx, but traffic from the Yankee game was backed up and the police pulled up right next to them.
Curry gets arrested with Guzman on September 20th.
Somewhere in the area, the police found the gun. First, they claimed that it was a .357, so they put that on the report and said, well, we found a gun, and this gun belongs to you guys. They never took any fingerprints of it, DNA, anything, and they said, well, this is your gun. And we tell them, this is not our gun from the beginning. This is not our gun. This is not our gun. And eventually, Pedro Guzman started talking to these people. He said, well, that's my friend's gun, and I got to talk to you. That's when he began to talk about the murder case.
While fending off suspicion and the attempted murder of Thomas Long, it appears that Guzman decided to try to save himself by cooperating. And at some point, the .357 Magnum became a .38 Special. I guess the police didn't know what kind of gun they allegedly found dumped from Guzman's car. Nevertheless, Guzman started to spill real information, mixed in with the lies, about the murder of Reginald Myers, which had occurred in the 30th Precinct.
They call in the 30th Precinct. This is when Detective De Leon get involved. Pedro Guzman admitted that him and two other individuals have been involved in that shooting of Reginald Myers. They never mentioned me. Somehow they pressured him, and then he implicated me in the crime.
They take a statement from Guzman, not knowing that, you know, this guy now is trying to dig himself up out of a really, really nefarious scenario here. Guzman's like, I know about this other murder, and Curry's involved with this murder, right? Basically says to De Leon that this .38 killed Myers. Turns out that .38 was not the murder weapon in Myers. There was a deformed 9mm bullet that was found in Myers' body, and that bullet was compared to the gun that was recovered in connection with Curry's arrest on the night of September 20th. The NYPD's own ballistic expert concluded that that 9mm bullet could not have been fired from that .38, that there was no connection between that gun and Myers at all.
But De Leon didn't know this information when he was working on these statements, first with Guzman, and then they picked up Miguel Enriquez, and lastly, Jerome.
Detective De Leon came in, this guy, him and another guy named Detective Trimus. We were kept in a freezer in approximately 48 hours, probably a little longer than that. Things got really bad, but you know, I continue to deny my involvement in it. The first thing they did was they brought in big color pictures of the victim, and they put them on a table. They were determined to get a confession. They say, you're going to tell us your side of the story. You know, it got so bad to the point where this detective, Elpidio De Leon, became abusive physically. You know, I remember him getting up. He went into a rage, punching and slapping me. And he said, well, you know, you're not leaving here until you tell us what we want to hear. You know, during this process, they brought in a TV screen with a DVD or a VCR player, and they continuously played the confession that this guy, Pedro Guzman, had already given them, and Miguel Enriquez, that they implicated in this crime as well.
Enriquez and Guzman both say that Enriquez jumps out of the car, takes the bag off of the victim, runs back to the 86 Acura dark gray four-door, and both of them say that the victim comes to the front windshield, slaps it, and Jerome shoots through the windshield. And see, that's the thing. The police could have easily gone to the autopsy to see that there was stippling on the body and automatically know that what Enriquez and Guzman are saying is false.
The windshield would have blocked any stippling at all from landing on Reginald Myers. And in addition, the 9mm bullet, not a .357 or a .38 caliber, but a 9mm bullet, entered through the back upper right arm and passed through the chest to the left. There was no upward trajectory that one might expect to have seen with a shot through the windshield. The shot, in fact, entered the back upper right arm. This scenario, in which Jerome is the shooter, simply defies reality.
And they kept telling me, just repeat what they are saying. You got to give us a story. You got to take some type of responsibility. And this went on for hours. Like, I never knew how serious sleep deprivation was, and not drinking water, not having access to food for so long really meant into experience that. They put me in a lineup. I later find out that the people that claimed that they seen me at the crime scene had identified a guy that was 6'1". I'm only 5'7".
How could a guy be identified as being 6'1" and be 5'7"?
Taking in consideration that I was sitting down when they made the identification with a bunch of other guys. So they didn't even see me standing up to compare me to the other individuals.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's a whole... I've never heard of a lineup sitting down.
Yeah, on a bench. So that's how they made the identification. So they said, well, you know, we got you. We got picked out of a lineup. There's people that seen you there. And it was all a lie. And it got so bad that I just wanted to end it. I ended up incriminating myself in this crime, even though I was innocent, which is something that I have regretted all these years because I have to live with that. My family have to live with that, you know?
You're listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early and ad-free by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts.
It started with a backpack at the 1996 Centennial Olympic Games. A backpack that contained a bomb. While the authorities focused on the wrong suspect, a serial bomber planned his next attacks. Two abortion clinics and a lesbian bar. But this isn't his story. It's a human story. One that I've become entangled with.
I saw, as soon as I turned the corner, basically someone bleeding out.
The victims of these brutal attacks were left to pick up the pieces, forced to explore the gray areas between right and wrong, life and death. Their once ordinary lives, and mine, changed forever.
It kind of gave me a feeling of pending doom.
And all the while, our country found itself facing down a long and ugly reckoning with a growing threat. Far-right, homegrown, religious terrorism. Listen to Flashpoint on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Katie Lowes.
And I'm Guillermo Diaz.
And now we're back with another season of our podcast, Unpacking the Toolbox, where Guillermo and I will be rewatching the show.
To officially unpack season 3 of Scandal.
Unpredictable, you don't see it coming. It's a wild, wild ride. The twists and turns in season 3.
Mesmerizing.
But also, we get to hang out with all of our old Scandal friends, like Bellamy Young, Scott Foley, Tony Goldwyn, Debbie Allen, Kerry Washington.
So many people.
Even more shocking assassinations from Papa and Mama Pope.
And yes, Katie and I's famous teeth-pulling scene that kicks off a romance.
And it was peak TV. This is new Scandal content for your eyes, for your ears, for your hearts, for your minds.
Well, suit up, gladiators. Grab your big old glass of wine and prepare yourselves for an even more behind the scenes. Listen to Unpacking the Toolbox on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Meet the real woman behind the tabloid headlines in a personal podcast that delves into the life of the notorious Tori Spelling as she takes us through the ups and downs of her sometimes glamorous, sometimes chaotic life and marriage.
I don't think he knew how big it would be, how big the life I was given and live is. I think he was like, oh, yeah, things come and go. But with me, it never came and went.
Is she Donna Martin or a down-and-out divorcee? Is she living in Beverly Hills or a trailer park? In a town where the lines are blurred, Tori is finally going to clear the air in the podcast Miss Spelling. When a woman has nothing to lose, she has everything to gain.
I just filed for divorce. Whoa. I said the words that I've said like in my head for like 16 years. Wild.
Listen to Miss Spelling on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As far as we can tell, the witnesses that viewed the sit-down lineup were never heard from again, but they served as an effective cudgel. They got Jerome to sign a confession, making him the shooter for Reginald Frazier, Reginald Myers, and Thomas Long. But as we've already pointed out, the statements were not corroborated by reality. And then they brought in Reggie Frazier, who was both the victim from July 15th, as well as the witness of the shooting in front of his crack spot, which one can surmise made him open for cooperation when he came in to view a lineup, especially when he's made to believe that the guy who shot his friend, Thomas Long, had been caught.
He said that he came in and he saw my picture on the detective's desk, and then he went into the lineup and identified me.
There's also another version of events where someone else at the 33rd Precinct, not Detective Primus, who was conducting the lineup, but somebody else showed him Jerome's picture by mistake. Either way, Reggie Frazier made the ID that was incentivized by not only a blind eye to his drug activity, but also just a few months before trial, trigger warning, 38-year-old Reggie Frazier had been charged with the rape of a 13-year-old child who became pregnant, receiving a sentence of only 1.5 to 3 years. Meanwhile, Jerome had awaited his trials for about that same amount of time on Rikers Island. His first trial was for the July 15th assault of Frazier and the attempted murder of Frazier's buddy, Thomas Long.
Reginald Frazier, he testified that he seen a white car. Somebody pointed a gun out of the window of the car and started shooting at him or the group that he was in. Long testified also, but he really didn't provide much information. He just said that, you know, he seen a white car. He couldn't identify the car. He don't even know where the shots came from. He just said he heard a shot and he started running. And, of course, a confession from me, an incriminating confession.
Now, as we've discussed, this alleged confession was about shooting Thomas Long from the car, even though the bullet path through Long's left shoulder placed the shooter on the sidewalk in front of or behind him, not in a car way off to his right, but none of this was ever explained to the jury. Then they moved on to the assault on July 15th.
Frazier said that he had a confrontation with a guy on 159th Street that he had never seen before at night, and the guy shot him as he tried to run away. He said, yeah, it's him right there, sitting right there.
Now, importantly, he reported that this was a black male, but changed this description to Hispanic male and ID'd Jerome, an ID that he appears to have been incentivized and guided to make. He also testified to having cooperated in other prosecutions, which could mean that he regularly traded testimony to maintain his own freedom and was not thereby a reliable source. But with Jerome's own statement corroborating this witness, he probably didn't have a chance anyway.
I didn't think so. One is because I wasn't allowed to take the stand and speak and defend myself, and for representation that I had, he never used his private investigator to go to the area and interview witnesses. And so I knew I was in trouble. They came in and they just handed out their verdict.
On March 17th, 1998, predictably, they found him guilty in both cases, ultimately resulting in two consecutive terms of 25 and 10 years for a total of 35 years. And then his second trial for the Myers murder began that August.
The only evidence against Jerome Curry is Guzman and Curry's statement. Henriquez does not testify at trial. He provides a statement to B.A. De Leon. And interestingly, Henriquez and Guzman's statements almost match identically, like almost word for word. We all have different perception, okay? So you're going to have different versions of the same event. Now, that's not going to contradict each other, but it's going to be slightly different. You're not going to have exactly the same statement, right? Word for word, that's not going to happen. They don't write those statements. De Leon does, right? But Henriquez doesn't testify at trial.
No, he didn't testify. And he told me, he said, listen, even though I implicated you in this murder, I know you wasn't there. They forced me to say these things about you. He said, Detective Leon forced me, Primus. You know, they put me in a room. They threatened to hit me. This is a guy that never been arrested. And he took a plea. He said, I'm not doing it. He said, I'm not going to testify. I'd rather take a plea offer. Just get on with my life and do whatever amount of years I have to do before I come in here and do that. And he never testified either. He refused to testify.
I forget how much time he gets. He does do a lot of time in prison, Henriquez. He does much more time than Guzman does, who does cooperate.
I think he did about 7 and some months. He did less than what he was supposed to do. So I don't know if they threw in a letter of consideration in there for him.
And Guzman says that when Henriquez comes into the car, the victim runs up to the front of the windshield and slaps the windshield.
They said that he was standing in front by the hood of the car with both hands raised in the air in a position to strike the windshield. So that means that the bullet would have struck him through his left side.
And he says Curry shoots through the front of the windshield. And what we know from the autopsy report is that there's stippling on the wound, which means two things, that this is a close gunshot wound. The other thing is there can't be an intermediary between the wound and the gun. completely refutes what Guzman is saying. And it's more that the victim, Myers, is running towards the car, reaching into the car, and is shot into the side of his body.
The autopsy says that the bullet entered through the back of his upper right arm, then entered the chest under the armpit, and traveled through the lungs and heart, which further makes sense when you know that the car was moving away from him. Picture the car, with the passenger side pulled up to the curb, Enriquez darting back into the car, Myers lunging for him. The car pulls away, and the shot was fired, making that back of the upper right arm through the chest trajectory possible.
Those DD5s that said there were some witnesses that said the car was already moving when Myers was shot, those DD5s weren't turned over at trial because it would have contradicted Guzman's trial testimony and Curry that the shooting happens when the car is stationary.
The jury never heard how the state's narrative was impossible, nor did they hear from a single alibi witness.
Jerome's girlfriend and mother both said that he was in Trenton. He has another guy named Figueroa. He was with Figueroa at like a birthday party at the time in Trenton. None of those people were called in Jerome's defense at trial. The defense attorney, essentially, he relied on his ability to cross-examine Guzman and to basically say, hey, the .38 is not, in fact, a murder weapon. And of course, Jerome gets convicted.
Which is predictable considering that the jury heard Jerome's false statement. So he got another 25-year sentence.
At the moment, I didn't really comprehend what was going on. I couldn't put together the sentence. I just heard, I hereby sentence you to 25 to life. And I started adding up the years, which turned the entire sentence into 60 to life. 60 to life, yep. But at that moment, everything just goes quiet. Everything goes numb. It's like everything just going in slow motion. Then you go upstate.
It started with a backpack at the 1996 Centennial Olympic Games. A backpack that contained a bomb. While the authorities focused on the wrong suspect, a serial bomber planned his next attacks. Two abortion clinics and a lesbian bar. But this isn't his story. It's a human story. One that I've become entangled with.
I saw, as soon as I turned the corner, basically someone bleeding out.
The victims of these brutal attacks were left to pick up the pieces, forced to explore the gray areas between right and wrong, life and death. Their once ordinary lives, and mine, changed forever.
It kind of gave me a feeling of pending doom.
And all the while, our country found itself facing down a long and ugly reckoning with a growing threat. Far-right, homegrown, religious terrorism. Listen to Flashpoint on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Katie Lowes.
And I'm Guillermo Diaz.
And now we're back with another season of our podcast, Unpacking the Toolbox, where Guillermo and I will be rewatching the show.
To officially unpack season 3 of Scandal.
Unpredictable, you don't see it coming. It's a wild, wild ride. The twists and turns in season 3.
Mesmerizing.
But also, we get to hang out with all of our old Scandal friends, like Bellamy Young, Scott Foley, Tony Goldwyn, Debbie Allen, Kerry Washington.
So many people.
Even more shocking assassinations from Papa and Mama Pope.
And yes, Katie and I's famous teeth-pulling scene that kicks off a romance.
And it was peak TV. This is new Scandal content for your eyes, for your ears, for your hearts, for your minds.
Well, suit up, gladiators. Grab your big old glass of wine and prepare yourselves for an even more behind the scenes. Listen to Unpacking the Toolbox on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Meet the real woman behind the tabloid headlines in a personal podcast that delves into the life of the notorious Tori Spelling as she takes us through the ups and downs of her sometimes glamorous, sometimes chaotic life and marriage.
I don't think he knew how big it would be, how big the life I was given and live is. I think he was like, oh yeah, things come and go. But with me, it never came and went.
Is she Donna Martin or a down and out divorcee? Is she living in Beverly Hills or a trailer park? In a town where the lines are blurred, Tori is finally going to clear the air in the podcast, Miss Spelling. When a woman has nothing to lose, she has everything to gain.
I just filed for divorce. Whoa. I said the words that I've said like in my head for like 16 years. Wild.
Listen to Misspelling on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
At that age, you go upstate, they send you all close to Canada, the Clinton Correctional Facility, and you know, that's when you feel that, you know, it's over. You know, with all the histories of officers killing prisoners and prisoners killing prisoners, and you know, all the violence and all the drugs and all everything that just goes on in places like that. It was horrible. You know, there's no way to prepare for that.
While enduring the worst of New York State prisons, Jerome began to learn the law, meanwhile receiving denials on appeal until he filed his federal habeas petition.
They granted me a hearing. They said they asked three questions, and two of them were, did my defense counsel ever make an attempt to contact the witnesses that described me as being 6'1"? And if he didn't, whether that deficiency affected the trial. So they vacated that conviction and sent it back to the district court. And when I got a hearing, I wasn't as prepared. You know, I wasn't as educated. I really didn't know the law as much as I know now. So when I went to the hearing, the magistrate judge, which is a guy named Andrew Peck, he was very tough. And instead of answering the questions or having the question answered by the Second Circuit, he turned it around and made it into whether I asked my counsel to call these witnesses. But that was not the question by the court. They asked whether his deficient performance in calling these witnesses affected the trial. And he never addressed that. He turned it around and found a way to deny the motion based on that. He said, oh, well, you never asked him to call these witnesses. Which I did, by the way. I testified at the hearing, and I said, yes, I did ask him multiple times. You know, I was very interested in hearing from these witnesses that described me as being 6'1", and then, you know, here I am at 5'7", and he never called them in.
While these witness descriptions in the Myers case likely referred to Miguel Enriquez, those same witnesses allegedly identified Jerome while he was seated. But regardless of how problematic all of that is, the judge still found a way to deny the claim. The next bit of progress came with Justin's involvement in 2016 when he did what Jerome's trial attorney never did, an actual investigation, starting with alibi witnesses like Eduardo Figueroa.
I know this guy for years, and my mother had ran into his family, his father, in Trenton, New Jersey. So his father gave him the number. He immediately traveled up here, and I haven't seen this guy in probably 25 years. And he was shocked to hear that I had been incarcerated for a crime that happened when we were together in Trenton, New Jersey.
So Figueroa gives an affidavit that Jerome was at a party in Trenton at the time of the homicide, and Jerome's mother and girlfriend both say during that week, right, that he was down in Trenton.
He also did a reinvestigation of the Myers crime scene with two forensic pathologists, Drs. Thomas Kubik and Cyril Wecht, the latter of whom is such a legendary figure. I mean, he actually worked the Kennedy assassination and countless other cases since then.
Dr. Wecht has probably been involved with over 50,000 autopsies. He gave the report back in 2022. And Dr. Kubik basically says the same thing as Dr. Weck. So we have two experts that basically say that Guzman's trial testimony and Enriquez's statement are physically impossible.
Everything we've been saying about how the ballistics contradict the state's evidence comes from them. And as we've already mentioned, Justin also got an affidavit from Miguel Enriquez saying that Jerome was never involved in any way. So as Justin has said, his initial focus is the Myers case, which he has now fully dismantled. The only way this could be better would be if Guzman reappeared from the Dominican Republic to corroborate everything we already know well enough, even without him. And then there's the state star witness from the first trial, none other than Reggie Frazier.
I found on a FOIA request in recent years, I think it was in 2017 or 18, with the help of a friend of mine, this guy, Reginald Frazier, gave two different descriptions, but that was never turned over. I just recently found that out.
And this is when Jerome finally knew what we've been saying about Frazier's credibility issues. Then, once again, contrary to Frazier's testimony, the ballistics in Long's case proved that the shooter must have been on the sidewalk and not in a passing white sedan. And the backdrop for Frazier's participation in both trials is the police ignoring his drug trafficking while giving him a sweetheart deal for his rape charge. So while we still don't have definitive proof that Jerome didn't shoot Frazier in the ass on July 15, 1996, we do have the word of a 38-year-old man who impregnated a 13-year-old child. In addition, Jerome has said in writing that he's ready and willing to submit to DNA testing to exclude himself from the 38. While that weapon is excluded from the Myers case, it's just one more corroboration that he was not involved in the other two incidents in which the police say that gun was involved. So hopefully Justin's going to be able to obtain that testing as well as additional info further discrediting Frazier. In the meantime, they're awaiting the decision on the 440 motion in the Myers case.
And what I believe is you have to take one piece at a time here. And what we know is one of his convictions, at the very least, is wrong. And it's the most serious conviction. And it shows, this conviction shows, it is a testament that the other convictions that he has are, at the very least, highly, highly problematic. And that they just went all out, didn't care. They used coercive tactics. They manufactured evidence. They just didn't care. So I don't want to move on anything until I'm sure. And what I am very, very certain about is that Jerome Curry did not kill Reginald Myers. And he was not there when Reginald Myers was killed. And we have a person that's in the car. Miguel Enriquez is now saying that Jerome Curry wasn't even in the car, wasn't there, wasn't present at all. And he's admitting that I was there. I took the bag. He's admitting his involvement in the murder. He's admitting it. And he's saying Curry had nothing to do with it. And we have alibis. And the question I have is what part of this case isn't covered by the evidence that we put in that motion? Why aren't we working with the prosecutor's office when they discover that you have a detective that has a pattern? We've begun to establish a pattern. The FBI says a serial killer is defined by what? Two or more murders, I think it is. That's the definition here. We know that De Leon beat at least one person, found guilty of that internally from the NYPD, and that the New York County District Attorney's Office has made allegations that he fabricated and manufactured evidence in another case that led to an exoneration of another man. Shouldn't we now begin to look at everything B.A. De Leon does? But I could tell you, I spoke to him about Jerome's case, and he still believes that 38 was the murder weapon. It's in his notes. It's in his notes. He still believes that. And he told me techniques that he used to get people to identify people in photo arrays and lineups and things like that. Basically, in six packs, he would put people in 2 and 5. And in lineups, he would push people into 3 and 4 because people go to the middle of the lineup first. And that increased the chance of identification exponentially. And then he had techniques about confessions. Obviously, Jerome knows about the confessions better than I do. I don't think I was with BA for over 40 hours straight.
I sincerely hope that the Manhattan DA's office takes a hard look at this case. You've got two incidents in which the ballistics cleared Jerome Curry and exposed the false testimony of the victim from another incident, who appears to have had plenty to gain from cooperating. So now, with that, let's go to closing arguments. I'm going to first thank you guys for being here and sharing this incredibly important story. So with that, I'm going to turn off my microphone and kick back in my chair and just listen to anything else you have to say. Justin, let's start with you and then hand it off to Jerome and he'll take us off into the sunset.
Once you see one of these tainted investigations where the cops don't care, you then have to look at the other ones. The DA's office even has more information on Elpidio De Leon. I'm still fighting for the rest of the information about his involvement, and his involvement is only in the Myers case. But the other detectives that were involved in the other two cases were feeding off of him. They were obligated even 28 years ago to turn over the fact that BA had abused another witness, okay? They were obligated when they exonerated Jabbar Walker to turn over their findings in November of 2023, where Elpidio De Leon was the lead investigator. And here, every single piece of evidence against Jerome Curry was tainted by confirmation bias, contextual bias, by police officers that thought that their intuition took them to the right person, by witnesses that were willing to say whatever they had to say to get out of jail. And I know that's a common theme, but here we can prove that. Physical evidence that we can prove. We can prove that Jerome Curry was held, even by the NYPD's own admission, for well over a day, over 30 hours. By the NYPD's own admission, they kept him and interrogated him over and over and over again until they got the information out of him that they wanted. Not true factual information, not information that was corroborated by the physical evidence. And that's what I want people to understand. The police's own techniques say that the physical evidence should match the statement of the person that's confessing. We don't have any of that here. There's not one piece of evidence that's used to convict Jerome Curry, the Reginald Myers case, that's reliable. Not one.
I want to address your listeners, those that are, you know, familiar with the criminal justice system, as well as those that are not, you know, as well as the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, and even the judge, you know, whose passion I'm seeking in proving my innocence in this case that is before her present, you know, in her office right now. As far as I know, no one is above the law in this country. And the cornerstone of our constitutional law states that no one is above the law. And this includes members of the District Attorney's Office in Manhattan, as well as law enforcement. Now, people may not know this, but in a motion such as the one that my attorney put together and submitted to the court, that is for requesting a new trial based on newly discovered evidence, the judge has a duty or is required to conduct a careful and dispassionate examination of the facts as presented in the papers that we submitted. And most importantly, the application of the law to those facts, which is what we have been requesting. We are requesting that the law is applied to the facts that we have presented in all our submissions. That's it. You know, I want to emphasize that from the outset, from the inception of my criminal prosecutions, I have always claimed my innocence. And as it is demonstrated by the reinvestigation of my case, as well as the large amount of compelling newly discovered evidence that is attached to the 440 motion that is pending right now in New York County Supreme Court, my wrongful conviction was the result of deficient representation by my trial attorney, by the suppression of exculpatory evidence, by the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, and I think also very importantly, by the outrageous misconduct and corrupt investigative techniques of Detective Elpidio de Leon. Detective de Leon has an extensive career history of engaging in acts of misconduct and using corrupt investigative practices against criminal defendants and suspects. For approximately 28 years, I have been claiming that these very same acts of misconduct were used against me by Detective Peter Leon, who forced me to make a terminating confession against myself in a crime that I did not commit. Just like Jabbar Walker, I am also 100% innocent, and I'm just requesting for justice to be delivered in my favor and for the application of the law through the facts of my case to be implemented. You know, I'm innocent. I just want my day in court, and I want to be able to prove my innocence, and I would like to be exonerated from this crime.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts. I want to thank our production team, Connor Hall and Kathleen Fink, as well as my fellow executive producers, Jeff Kempler, Kevin Wardis, and Jeff Clyburn. The music in this production was supplied by three-time Oscar-nominated composer, Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us across all social media platforms at Lava for Good and at Wrongful Conviction. You can also follow me on Instagram at It's Jason Flom. Wrongful Conviction is a production of Lava for Good Podcasts in association with Signal Company No. 1.
Hello, my name is Jose Hernandez, and the Wrongful Conviction Podcast just opened my eyes to the world of wrongful convictions and the innocent movement and just how often this happens to everyday people. But I would say this podcast did influence me to pursue my legal career, now going into my second year of Loyola Law School, and I'm going to be a part of their Loyola Project for the Innocent this upcoming semester, so I'm really excited for that. And I owe it all to the Wrongful Conviction Podcast for really leading me that way and inspiring me to do the work that I hear so many of these attorneys do. Thank you, and keep up the great work. Keep pumping out those stories, and I can't wait to join the movement.
Back in 96, Atlanta was booming with excitement around hosting the Centennial Olympic Games. And then, a deranged zealot willing to kill for a cause, lit a fuse that would change my life and so many others forever, rippling out for generations. Listen to Flashpoint on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Katie Lowes.
And I'm Guillermo Diaz.
And we're the hosts of Unpacking the Toolbox, the Scandal Rewatch podcast where we're talking about all the best moments of the show.
Mesmerizing.
But also, we get to hang out with all of our old Scandal friends like Bellamy Young, Scott Foley, Tony Goldwyn, Debbie Allen, Kerry Washington.
Well, suit up, gladiators. Grab your big old glass of wine and prepare yourselves for even more behind-the-scenes stories with Unpacking the Toolbox.
Listen to Unpacking the Toolbox on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts,
or wherever you get your podcasts.
Meet the real woman behind the tabloid headlines in a personal podcast that delves into the life of the notorious Tori Spelling as she takes us through the ups and downs of her sometimes glamorous, sometimes chaotic life and marriage.
I just filed for divorce. Whoa. I said the words that I've said like in my head for like 16 years. Wild.
Listen to Miss Spelling on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.